And it has to do with my Dharma talks going forward. I have 34 days left on my 30-year tenure as a faculty member at the University of Colorado. But who's counting? So I'm going to have probably more free time to play with the Dharma than I have in the past. And that could take different forms, but it depends in part on what your views are, what your thoughts are, what your judgment is in terms of how you would like to spend our time together on the evenings when I'll be speaking or when I'll be here. One possibility, having been a career academic, is to do what I've kind of been doing lately, which is to present some stepwise teachings out of the Greater Discourse on the Establishment of Mindfulness. You know, I've basically been teaching the Mahaisatipatthana Sutta since last fall, you know, since the October intro, except for the month, the 2 months of the Sadhana focused on the Brahma Viharas. And the Four Elements is indeed, you know, one of those sets of teachings that's embedded within the first foundation of mindfulness in the Sadhana Sutta. And then we're, of course, leading up to sprouting wings and taking a dive into the exploration of not-self. So I could sort of continue to do that. In fact, it's been suggested that if there were a kind of a curriculum laid out, you know, kind of a list of what topics that I was going to be covering when, that for people who are interested in deepening their Dharma study, all those topics, you know, there's a ton of stuff out on the internet available for free online, including access to Insight and other places you could go to educate yourself if you really wanted to read up on one of these topics or another before I offer it. And so, you know, being by nature an academic, that has a certain appeal for me. I'm also a little worried about it maybe getting a little dry or too structured. And then sometimes also, if there's something that really it's really coming up, whether it's society or something that's happened in my own practice or something that seems really worthwhile focusing on or paying attention to, I might not necessarily have much juice for whatever it is that's on the reading, you know, the teaching schedule for that for a particular meeting. And so I'm a little concerned about it being so structured and maybe becoming a little too academic or dry and thus not maybe coming up a little short in the spontaneity department from time to time. Or maybe not being as responsive as it would be useful to be if we have sort of events going on that we want to reflect on how to apply the Dharma to. So what do you think? Yeah, please, John.
The advantage of scheduling stuff is if I find out about something that happens tomorrow and I'm already booked, I can't make it. If I know in advance that something's going to be there, whether or not you've got, you know, and if you say, if you change up at the last minute and say, well, I'm going to do this next time, that's okay. But the point is, it's on my schedule.
Yeah.
And I'm much more likely to attend if it's on my schedule.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Other views, other thoughts? It's your song, man. Come on.
I'd be happy if you just kept going along with what you're doing. As you say, just avoiding it being too dry or academic, but to do the in-depth things would be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, we've been sitting together for quite some time now, over 18 years, and we are an open sangha, and so we have some people who are just now introducing themselves to the Dharma and getting some sense of what it's about and whatnot. And we have other people who've been sitting for quite a long time and have done a lot of long retreats and have been doing a lot of reading and studying on their own. And the challenge for me, of course, is how to offer teachings that are relevant to everybody, you know, regardless of your level of experience or reading. Going the more structured way would be a chance for people who really want to deepen their, not only their practice, but their understanding of the Dharma, to do so. I don't want to be, you know, promising too much I may or may not be able to deliver down the road, but I, there's a teacher in San Francisco, an extraordinarily skilled Dharma teacher. He's one of the founding teachers of Spirit Rock, named Eugene Cash. Very inspirational Dharma teacher, very robust, lively, popular Sangha in San Francisco. Been going on for several years now. And I was, last summer I attended a conference of Dharma leaders and teachers and service committee members of Sanghas, insight meditation Sanghas from all over the country. And one of the things that we focused on, and that there's actually a fair amount of buzz about right now in Dharma circles, is basically Dharma succession. Those of us that have really, Dharma succession, yeah, some of those of us who've been around, who've been at this for a while, for instance, I started sitting with Jack and Joseph and Sharon before there was a Spirit Rock and before there was an Insight Meditation Society in 1975. You know, we're all these kind of second generation Dharma bums, you know. And then, and over that time, we, you know, I've gone to a lot of retreats and we've done a lot of sitting and we've got trained in how to teach the Dharma and whatnot. But the turning of the wheel being what it is, you know, I may or may not be around 10 years from now, right? In Eugene's case, the reason I raised that example was that the summer before last, he's a really avid bike rider and he goes on these charity rides and whatnot all the time. And he had a massive over-the-handlebars, cartwheeling through the air, landing really the wrong way, bike wreck. And he was in the ICU for a while, and then he was somewhat dysfunctional for quite a while after that. He's now mostly healed, and one of his service committee chairs at this meeting said, well, you know, he's a terrific teacher, but he did a really lousy job of planning for his bike wreck. And so there arises this question of sustaining the Sangha. You know, I'm not planning to go anywhere. I don't really quite know what the universe has in mind for me. Another thing that it seems to me would be worthwhile to do would be to initiate some kind of a training program for people who really do have some background and some experience and really like to take on some responsibility both for learning more about the Dharma and also for teaching it. And so thinking about maybe initiating something, some kind of, you know, Dharma presentation program, you know, for people to, within the Sangha, to take turns sharing the Dharma with each other. Probably with a reading list and some themes and stuff of that nature. So, how does that sound to you as something that, yes, please.
I think that sounds really neat. And I think that it's an option that perhaps a lot of the people who are interested in getting more into the text would probably exercise that option to deepen their practice in that way.
Yeah.
And in that case, I really like the spontaneity of kind of whatever, especially in responding to, I feel like if something comes up in someone's personal practice, I feel like often it's coming up in other people's personal
yep.
practice, whether that be because of like seasonal energies or social mm-hmm. forces. And that way, I like when the talks are spontaneous because the subject material seems to really resonate with whatever is going on.
Yeah, okay. I can hear that. So what I would like to do would be to offer, you know, it's not real clear in my mind because I'm also planning to do a fair amount of traveling over the next few months. It'd be a program for people, anyone who really wants to enrich their Dharma knowledge and their practice, okay? And then within that, people who would be willing to take the Dharma seat from time to time. You know, and in the old days, and I might start doing this again, I didn't always just sit up here and yap. Sometimes we'd break into small groups and we'd have questions we'd work with and whatnot, so we could get back to doing more of that kind of thing again. So it's more interactive, sort of peer-to-peer. And so, but at the same time, when I was being trained, one of the things our teachers would say from time to time is, well, Bhikkhu Bodhi was the one who has really spelled this out most clearly for us. He was the guy who was probably the foremost English language translator of the Pali texts, right? What the historical Buddhas thought to have said. And he said, really, ever since the Buddha's time, the sharing of the Dharma has moved forward in basically two different forms. And one is what he called canonical Buddhism. And what he was talking about there is teaching the Dharma straight out of the texts. And in the Theravada case, it's the texts that contain the words that the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, is actually thought to have said. Okay. Which is not the same as the canonical texts and Mahayana Buddhism, okay, or Vajrayana Buddhism necessarily. So just don't say stuff the Buddha didn't say. It was basically, you know, what he said. There's a whole website devoted to stuff the Buddha never said, which is kind of interesting because if you go and have a look at it, there's a lot of stuff in there that you kind of thought that he did. And they also said, well, you know, and teach based on your own experience. You know, if you're teaching texts, things out of the text that you don't have personal experience of, doesn't mean don't teach them. It says this is not within my realm of personal experience. So that's a canonical Buddhism. The other is what he called adaptive Buddhism. And by that he meant anything that you come across that in your view, you know, if it's something out of the contemporary culture or anything else, or other texts from other traditions even, that kind of gets at the essence of what the Buddha was trying to convey, go for it. And so from time to time, that may include the poems of Jalaluddin Rumi, for instance, or people from other, you know, I take stuff out of the Bible from time to time, New Testament for the most part. So he said, adaptive Buddhism, fine. It's been going on for 2,000 years. That's how the Dharma makes it from one culture to another. But you need to be well enough grounded in your own knowledge and understanding of what the Buddha said, not just, you know, the words, but also your lived experience of the words in order to be able to convey them. So I'd be more than happy to put together some kind of series of presentations around that, and this would be something in addition to, you know, this, the talks I give twice a month. For people that would be invited to take the Dharma seat, in my view, it would be nice if for people who had some kind of baseline practice experience that included residential retreat setting on an ongoing basis, so there'd be enough experiential grounding on the part of whoever was offering the Dharma on a given evening, so that you're able to speak from the basis of your own experience rather than simply something you've read or something you've heard. So those are issues that I turn over in my mind from time to time. So basically just wanted to say that these are things that I'm thinking about. We may have something come forth as a result. And I would appreciate hearing anything that you might want to have to say about what I just said.
Some people might be looking for a teacher. People are, you know, from time to time looking for a teacher. Are you the one to do any of that?
You know, people keep asking me when I come up on retirement, well, what are you going to do? And the answer I've been giving more and more is that, you know, I've been really doing for for the last 40 years. You know, I really want to experiment with just being for a while. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I feel like my current level of commitment or something, perhaps a little more in the realm of teaching and just sharing, is fine. I've shied away, as you know, over all these years for, except for persons who are really, really jammed up or experiencing, you know, sort of acute need at any given time. I've tended not to try to make myself available for very much kind of one-on-one mentoring in the Dharma, because I just don't have the energy, the wherewithal to do that in a responsible way. There are teachers who spend big chunks of their life doing exactly that, you know, living out the Dharma. That's not something I've done because I didn't, you know, don't make promises you can't keep. And also because going forward, I really need to kind of just be my own teacher for a while before kind of offering things more broadly. But thank you for asking. Okay, please.
A couple of things come to mind for me when you ask that. One, about the nature of our Sangha. We're getting this really nice generational mix.
I'm so pleased to see
and
that.
It's great. And I feel as if we need to leave, kind of make room for both.
Yep.
And particularly as younger Buddhists come in, we want them to be welcome, we want them to get involved in their own group, growth and leadership and so on. So that's just an observation.
Yep.
The other observation I've made is that, and I've heard other people kind of asking for this, is that when we have those little small group discussions, there's such a liveliness.
Yes.
And especially then when it's in interacting with you. So the question comes up and we generate some things and then maybe pose you some questions to you and that type of thing.
Yes.
So I think that can be really rich on an ongoing basis too. And then what I'm hoping is that maybe you'd be open for us just to suggest topics. Because as we're sitting here and as you talk, I think, yeah, I'd really like to hear you talk about this or this or this. So maybe we could just open that and slip you a note or email you as things come up, and you may or may not address
those. Sure. Fine. I don't think I've heard from anyone under 40 yet. Oh, is that for you? Yes. Thank you. Right. Anybody else in that age range that might want to share?
But don't feel on the spot.
Right.
I'm not under 40 either.
Oh, all right.
I like the idea of you having a structure, a plan, from week to week. In our personal lives, we all have different things maybe that we, that subject maybe isn't quite as important to me, but this subject maybe would be. But I also think that the spontaneity is great, and if something comes up that if we could all be flexible enough to go with the flow, and if things change, things change. And that's the nature of why we're here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good.
It is nice to have kind of a somewhat of a plan.
Yep.
I like that idea.
Okay. Yeah, please, Luke.
Yeah, I was going to pretty much comment the same thing. It's sort of a both and thing. That if we knew, it'd be great. However, the Dharma is most powerful when it's related from your current experience. So if something changed, great. That would be good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always best when it takes on a life of its own.
Yeah, I think they just need to be flexible.
Yeah. Please.
I heard your comment about just not having the bandwidth to do one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
What about one-on-several in helping us learn how to transmit the Dharma? Mm-hmm. Is that something you might consider?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a problem. Yeah, that's what I was actually envisaging. You know, anyone who really wanted to get down with the Dharma, I'd do a kind of a smaller group, and then among that group, those who might be willing to take the Dharma seed.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, when it's this kind of peer thing, I really recommend people do it in pairs.
Yeah. Ah.
Yeah, so you don't get so freaked at the idea of being up here all. Yeah.
What happens there
that you would recommend?
Huh?
What happens there that you would recommend? Did you just say varying?
I just said that it works oftentimes when we have members of the Sangha leading, you know, that if you teach in pairs.
Oh, in pairs.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, good. Thank you. Please.
Well, I do want to say something about, I think some people wonder, do I have to be a genuine Buddhist to show up here? can I just come and meditate and sit and listen?
Somebody asked Ajahn Amaro once, another sort of dear teacher of mine in robes, well, how do I know if I'm a Buddhist? And he said, you're a Buddhist if you say you are. Interestingly, about 10 years ago, somebody asked the teachers at Spirit Rock Meditation Center if they self-identify as Buddhists, and only about half of them said yes.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Very different story with the teachers at the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie. That was at a time when I think Spirit Rock was still in the process of trying to figure out what it was in terms of, is it just kind of New Age growth center, or is it really going to be about Buddha Dharma period? So, interesting question. What's a Buddhist, right? When somebody asks me if I am, I say, yeah, you know, I self-ascribe, and as somebody who studies the teachings of the Buddha and seeks to practice those teachings, and for me that's pretty much one working definition. Whether you think the Buddha was right in terms of the, you know, Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and whether you seek to live within those parameters, I think that's pretty good indication. I think the reticence has to do with the way we hold religious traditions in this culture, which is that, you know, I grew up in the Baptist Church, you know, and we wouldn't give the time of day to the Methodists. So it's like you sign up for a denomination like you would a political party or something, you know, and there are these fairly rigid differences between one denomination and another. And so I think the reticence has to do in part with just wanting to try to step away from that a little bit. Because, you know, the great irony of it is, in the Buddha's teachings in the Second Noble Truth on the sources of suffering, and he says, well, it's clinging, it's craving and clinging. And then he talked about the kinds of things that we tend to cling to that are most difficult to let go of. And those having to do with attachment to sense desires, having to do with attachments to rites and rituals, thinking that they are the key to enlightenment rather than your own lived experience. Attachment to the notion of a permanent and abiding self, and attachment to views and opinions. And that has, you know, and back at the Barrie Center for Buddhist Study, they have two directors. They're basically one who's director of the Theravada Studies program, the other is director of the Mahayana Studies program. And those two traditions have been saying crap about each other for 1,500 years. And so it's like, you know, that's a tremendous irony in this, right? Since the Buddha said, you know, source of suffering, cling to views and opinions. And yet that's, you know, that's what these different Dharma traditions have been doing for a long time. And so that's the other reticence, I think, about self-identifying as Buddhist, is this notion of the Dharma really needing to be held lightly like a Fabergé egg, you know, and that its preciousness, you know, like that William Blake poem, you know, those who bind themselves to joy do the winged life destroy. Those who kiss the joy as it flies live in eternity's sunrise. Yeah. So that's this kind of this lightness, you know, this inviting the Dharma to come be observed, you know, that way of relating to it rather than trying to glom on to a certain set of doctrines or views and have that be what it means to be a Buddhist. That was one of the things the Buddha was really freaked about. He said, don't go there. No, it's not so helpful.
But isn't the term Buddhist kind of a new construct that we invented about in the last one?
The term Buddhism is a creation of Western academia. Yeah, if you go to Asia, you know, they talk about Buddha Dharma. They talk about the teachings of the Buddha. The term Buddhism came into being when religious scholars were engaged in this kind of comparative assessment of the Buddha Dharma as it manifested in India, as it manifested in Southeast and in East Asia, as it manifested in Tibet. It was a descriptive term for scholars rather than something that most self-ascribe to. And that being said, the Dharma, the Dalai Lama uses the term all the time, so there's that. But he's oftentimes doing so in an academic context.
So I'm sure the Earth Sila group is actively doing things, but I'd kind of like to see maybe once every 2 months or something a sangha that was devoted to the environment,
yep,
to the climate, to, you know, that was interactive or in some way designed that you would participate in,
sure,
to where we could apply the teachings to our work and the environment.
Yeah, the project is to some extent fallen victim to my own fluctuations in the energy level. You know, I managed to go out and get a little grant to help underwrite, you know, John's company's creation of a website for us. We had some core volunteers are working really hard adding content and whatnot. But I think I had higher hopes than we were able to manifest in terms of the harnessing of voluntary energy. And so we might be, you know, first off, those of us who've been active and are going to get together and say, okay, you know, how do we get this thing, you know, more in life and take it to the next level, which is going to be, in my case, much, much easier to do after mid-May. And I appreciate your pointing that out, because I too would love to see that be, you know, a more active part of what we do. In fact, the teachings, I'm only going to have about 15 minutes or so to get started with the four elements practice. And I like to teach the four elements practice in the spring because it's a time of kind of renewal, reconnection with nature. That's happening for me personally right now in terms of the volunteer work that I'm doing and that I'll be doing in the future, including, you know, out of state park, I'm going to be getting involved probably in some local environmental litigation. There are all these ways you can actually take these very rich ancient teachings and then plug them straight into what's going on around us right now. Including with the air, along with, of course, respect for the air itself, right? You know, we home tonight thank a tree. It's out there doing the same thing we are, right? Nourishing and cleansing, except that their cleansing is our nourishing, you know, in terms of the oxygen cycle. So, I think the bringing our relationship, our extra rational relationship to nature and the environment, this particular set of teachings provides a terrific vehicle for doing that. So it's definitely previews of coming attractions. All right, I'd like to hear from you now on a completely different subject, which is your practice of the four elements, air, you know, breathing visualization exercise this evening. It's Anapanasati is what it's called, you know, with a particular emphasis on the air element. So what was it like to spend as much of your time as possible focusing on this simple process of breathing?
You know, what arose in me was just tremendous gratitude and amazement at our bodies.
Oh.
Everything that's going on. I don't often pay attention to that. We do that.
Yeah, that's just amazing, right? But that every, you know, the billions, trillions, I don't know how many cells are in the body, but the fact that that simple process of respiration and circulation, you know, is nourishing and caring for every living cell in the body on a continuous basis. Absolutely remarkable. Thank you. Yeah, please.
What came up for me was initial like resistance to be given direction.
Okay.
And I found that as we started, it was really natural and very easy to like use that noting to follow. And I kept doing it even though initially I was very resistant, like,
all right,
I'm just gonna do whatever.
Great. So, great.
Yeah.
Yeah. It usually, for me, has a calming effect. I find that, you know, I tend to settle in more deeply and whatnot. And then the mind flies off into this, that, or the other thing, you know, writing some brief or something. And then I all of a sudden, come back to, you know, I knew a lawyer back east who said, a very successful public interest litigator, you know, litigates on behalf of people with disabilities and things. And he said, he really loved the deep, you know, tranquility. Shamatha is the Pali word for, translates as tranquility, and the four elements meditations are shamatha practices. They calm the mind and they allow you to focus on one thing so things become very still. I said, so yeah, I spent one retreat, you know, drafted my whole brief for my appeal to the First Circuit. All there in his mind, in the outline, the points and authorities, and the arguments it's going to make. And so it's like, okay, well. And you can, and you see it happening. He tried to go back to the breath and finds it off, what the hell. And so he wound up spending a fair amount of time in his mind, you know, preparing this brief. And then every once in a while, he'd realize, no, it's kind of a silly waste of time. And so then he'd fall into, you know, deep samadhi and do that for a while. And all of a sudden, there was the mind. So I was into some of that tonight. And also what happens for me, in addition to really getting calm and clear sometimes, is I get really sleepy and bored. That happened too, actually, come to think of it. Anyone else? Yeah, okay. What do you think that was about, the boredom and the sleepiness? No. Yeah, please.
The image of the tide coming and going and the creation of tide pools, that's pretty lulling.
It is.
But I loved the association with the inside of the lungs.
Yes.
You know, because they're both so fertile and.
Yes.
It was a very good direction that you gave us.
Thank you. And when I would look at the boredom, when it would arise, you know, boredom is not just, there's an element of aversion in boredom, you know, that somehow things as they are is not quite all right. You want something more to be happening. You want something to be going on. Or when I see the mind zigging off to, you know, some kind of planning exercise or other. Essentially, what that is in my own experience is the self trying to reassert itself. You know, it's like the discursive mind saying, oh, this is all very nice, but, you know, let's get back to work here. And so for me, it was to some extent, for some of the time, it was kind of like a ping pong match or something, you know. The skirts of mine would rise up and say, no, you know, let's not forget who's in charge here, after all. And then back to the breathing, and I could feel that relax a little bit. And so the to and fro, the back and forth, I realized was really nothing more than the discursive mind doing whatever was possible to not let go, to not just be with things as they are.
The way you describe the instructions, this is also very much a practice in concentration and focus, which for me is hard. So it's not like we're watching the next thought as it arises and decide whether it's going to be an object of meditation. It's like, no, we're back to nourishing and cleansing. I just find it challenging, but I find concentration meditation challenging.
Yes. I think for those of us with a busy mind, that tends to be the case. That's why they're so important to do.
Yeah. I really feel that this could be a profound healing technique of whatever ails you. I mean, I don't, I don't, I mean, I just intuitively feel that were we to give ourselves that kind of respect, give our bodies that kind of respect and attention, there will be healing.
Yes, absolutely. You know, ultimately, you know, the Buddha used the image of healing in the Dharma as medicine a lot, as teachings. And that's sort of what he was getting at, you know, that if instead of the discursive mind off doing its, you know, I-making and me-making, as he called it, and instead use the consciousness to entrain with what the body is already up to, or what it wants to do, I mean, with the nourishing and cleansing mantra, that's essentially what we're doing. We're kind of saying to ourselves what the body is literally doing at that point in time. For people that are working with dependencies and addictions, being able to get in touch with what the body is trying to do every second of the day, you know, in terms of nourishing itself, cleansing itself, healing itself, you know, to simply recognize and respect what's going on there is, you know, quite remarkable. There's a little introductory passage that that focuses on the text a little bit as an introduction that I'd at least like to share tonight by way of getting us, getting our feet wet a little bit so we can do the water element next time. We become what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. In this opening passage from the Dhammapada, the Buddha drew attention to how our state of mind conditions the way we see the world around us. He also taught that when the mind is engaged in what he called I-making or me-making, it creates a sense of self that is separate from, distinct from, and different from our surroundings. So the thoughts with which we create the world can also make us feel alien and to some extent disconnected from the great web of life of which we are a part. Why does the discursive mind do this? Why does it want to see itself as apart from nature rather than as a part of nature? The Buddha's answer is that it is because the mind-constructed self is afraid to age, to suffer infirmity, and to die. We see that every other living being in nature arises and changes and passes away. So to fully acknowledge that the similarities we share with all other life forms far outweigh the differences between us is also to acknowledge our own vulnerability and our own impermanence, which is not good news for the people. Yet it is just such a gesture of acknowledgement, of surrender to the unity with all life, that we must be willing to make in order to free ourselves from the isolation and alienation that a sense of self imposes. So that's why, that's why it's a useful thing to do. Okay. Well, I think what I'd like to do is to just hold off the really kind of diving in as far as the real meaning of the air element, how we work with it in our practice, how we can carry it into daily life, how it can both reaffirm our connection with the natural world, and also gradually start to soften the barriers a little bit, you know, to enrich our sense of linkage with the rest of the natural world. Until next time. So let's take just about a minute or two to settle in together. Allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. nourishing and cleansing. We become what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. Good week.
Thank you.
Good seeing you.